From WYPR, I'm Sheila Cast. We're on the record. It was a tragedy that Chester Arthur became president. Not only the tragedy of his predecessor's assassination in 1881, but the perceived tragedy by many that Vice President Arthur, a Republican Party hack from New York, would bring his machine politics into the Oval Office. He had consistently opposed cleaning up the corrupt, spoil system of federal jobs. But Arthur was inspired by letters of conscience from a stranger. He signed and implemented civil service reforms. Biographer Scott Greenberger says Chester Arthur is worth remembering because
the civil service reform really set the stage for the more activist federal government of Teddy Roosevelt and his successors. And besides his legacy as president, I think it's a fascinating personal story of redemption that people can relate to.
The unexpected president, on the record after the news.
You're listening to On the Record, the podcast, a service of your public radio, 88.1 WYPR. Find more podcasts online at wypr.org. And tell us what you think. Send an email to ontherecord@wypr.org.
Good morning. I'm Sheila Cast. We're On the Record. Let's admit it, most of us have only the vaguest concept of the men who occupied the Oval Office between the Civil War and World War I. Abraham Lincoln looms large, and then Theodore Roosevelt heaves into view at the turn of the 20th century. In between marches a muddle of white guys with facial hair who are pretty much interchangeable for most of us. I dare you to pick President Rutherford B. Hayes out of a lineup, or James Garfield. Maybe Civil War hero Ulysses S. Grant, because after all, his face is on the $50 bill. But Chester A. Arthur? Who is Chester Arthur? A new book gives us reason to care about the 21st president by weaving a tale of political redemption of a party hack who improbably became a reformer. Scott Greenberger has written The Unexpected President, The Life and Times of Chester A. Arthur. In his day job, Greenberger is executive editor of Stateline, a nonprofit news website that covers state politics and policy for dozens of newspapers. Scott Greenberger lives in Tacoma Park, and he's with me now in the studio. Welcome to On the Record.
Thank you very much for having me.
Before we get into some of the details, let me throw that umbrella question to you. You lived with this guy for 4 years researching this book. Who was Chester A. Arthur?
Well, Chester A. Arthur was a guy who, he was born in Vermont, and his father was a very rigid abolitionist preacher, very strict upbringing. But when he went away to college and became a young man, he ended up on a very different path. He started out on a very high-minded sort of a path. He became a teacher. He studied the law, became a lawyer, and was involved in the case and actually won the case that ended up desegregating New York City's streetcars.
Yeah, tell us about that. That was Elizabeth Jennings, an African-American school teacher who had been on a streetcar. What happened? What was
she
the case?
Was at that time, the streetcars were run privately. There were cars that were labeled for black passengers and cars that were reserved for white passengers. She was late for church with a friend of hers and decided to hop onto one of the cars that was not set aside for what were then called colored passengers, and there was a confrontation with the conductor that resulted in her being thrown off the streetcar.
This was in the 1850s?
Yes, it was, yeah.
So did this case, which Arthur won and got a fair amount of adulation from abolitionists and people who supported black rights, does that tell us something about his values?
Well, I think it tells us, first of all, that he had absorbed his father's abolitionism. I mean, even at the time, at this time before the Civil War, it wasn't the case that everybody in the North was an abolitionist. And in fact, Chester Arthur's father had been pretty much kicked out of a couple of his congregations for being too vehemently anti-slavery. Chester Arthur's involvement in this case shows that he had absorbed those abolitionist beliefs and was sort of on a very idealistic path.
The big theme of most of Chester Arthur's professional life was as a cog in the New York Republican machine, the political machine. Did he consciously choose that or sort of fall into it?
He gradually fell into it, if that's possible. It was a little of both. So after the Civil War, he wanted to, as many young people want to do, he wanted to make a name for himself, wanted to make some money. At this point, he was married, and his wife had wealthy tastes. She had come from money. And he decided that the way to make a name for himself in New York and to make some money was to attach himself to the Republican, what later became the Republican machine, at first the Whig Party in New York. And he had two very powerful and influential patrons at this time. One was Thurlow Weed, who was kind of the prototypical political boss in New York, and then later a man named Edwin Morgan, who became governor. And they both sort of helped Arthur along on this upward path toward being a more relevant political person in New York. But the person who really became his mentor was a guy named Roscoe Conkling, who succeeded Weed as boss of the New York machine and was a very flamboyant and colorful figure. And he was really the one who cleared the way for Arthur to become vice president and later president.
What did Roscoe Conkling see in Chester Arthur? What was the appeal to that party boss to take Arthur on as his sort of
his protege? Yeah. Well, it's interesting. Roscoe Conkling was a very successful politician, and he was a very impressive looking person. He was over 6 feet tall. He had he was very famous for a curl that he liked to keep right on his forehead. It was very often showed up in the cartoons. But strangely, he was a politician who didn't really love people. He didn't like to be touched. He was very fastidious in that way. And Arthur was a perfect complement to him because Arthur loved people. Arthur was a guy who was, he was always the life of the party. He was always the one who wanted to stay up into the early morning hours talking politics. And so he was a perfect lieutenant for Roscoe Conkling.
That's journalist and author Scott Greenberger here on The Record on WIPR. I'm Sheila Cast. We're talking about his new book to be published tomorrow, The Unexpected President, The Life and Times of Chester A. Arthur. So the big accomplishment of that phase of Chester Arthur's life was as the collector of the Port of New York, the head of the New York Customs House, which sounds very tame, but it involved enormous power as well as money. How did the Customs House work?
The Custom House, this was a time, of course, before there was an income tax. And the Custom House for New York, other ports had Custom Houses too, but New York then as now was a very large port that was the most important port in the United States. And something like 70% of the government, the federal government's income came through that port. So they collected duties on the goods that came into New York. Being collector of the Custom House was a very important job. First of all, it was a very lucrative job because as collector, you were entitled to take a cut of the penalties that importers had to pay when they violated the rules. But more importantly, it was an entity with a lot of jobs that needed to be filled, and therefore it was very valuable for a machine politician like Arthur because he could reward party loyalists with jobs there. And then once they had the jobs there, tap them for campaign contributions. They had what were called voluntary assessments, but really they were anything but voluntary. And employees, based on their salaries, if they had gotten their jobs because of party connections, and most of them had, they were expected to donate to the party during campaigns. So it was a very important position for Roscoe Conkling as the boss of the Republican machine to control and to have one of his lieutenants in.
And I just want to make sure that we're following. This was a state party machine, but these were federal jobs.
That's right. These were federal jobs. It was Roscoe Conkling by this point was a senator, and it was
a U.S. senator.
And it was understood at this time that senators would have the ability to put their own people in these kinds of big federal jobs in their home states.
And this isn't what, I mean, we're kind of accustomed in civil service now that there is a layer of political appointees at the top of an organization who set policy, and that's the argument for them to be political people. But the rank and file are insulated from that. This was not the case.
This was not the case. And in fact, this situation led to sort of the defining moment of Arthur's life and presidency. This whole idea of the civil service being having civil service exams, making sure that people who fill federal jobs are actually qualified to do the job. This was something that at that time did not exist. As you know, now we're used to certain federal jobs being political jobs, but then almost every federal job was a political job, and they were handed out by party leaders as a reward for loyalty. And this is how the party in power perpetuated its power.
How on earth did such a party hack as Chester Arthur end up on the National Republican ticket as candidate for vice president in 1880?
Well, it was a surprising development even to him. What happened was Conkling was the leader of a faction of the Republican Party in 1880 that was trying to bring back former President Grant as a candidate to serve a third term, which would have been unprecedented at the time. And what happened was he lost that fight. Eventually, they settled on a compromise candidate that everybody could at least accept, and that was James Garfield. But they knew that this very ugly fight had angered Roscoe Conkling. He had lost, been on the losing end of this fight, but he was the Republican boss of New York, and New York was the most populous state in the Union, and the Republicans absolutely needed New York and the New York Republican Party if Garfield had any chance of winning the White House. And so to placate Conkling, they offered the second spot on the ticket to his lieutenant, Chester Arthur. Many, many people were surprised by this decision. One person who had also competed for the nomination said the only office that Arthur ever held was the one he was removed from, referring to his job as collector of the customs house when President Hayes, who was also reform-minded, had eventually removed Arthur from that job. So when Arthur landed on the GOP ticket in 1880, he didn't really have a job other than being Conkling's lieutenant. He didn't hold elective office and hadn't held any elective office and didn't hold any government office at that point. But to placate Conkling, they decided it made sense to give the nod to Arthur. And they figured Garfield's a young man. The vice president doesn't do much anyway. In fact, there were some people, reform-minded Republicans, who said, well, Arthur can do a lot less damage as vice president than he could as Conkling's lieutenant in New York. So let's just give him the job and then Conkling will help us.
On July 2nd, 1881, President Garfield was shot. I had always heard Garfield was shot by a, quote, a disgruntled office seeker, close quote, but I had never connected that to the idea of civil service. Was there a connection?
There was. I mean, it's certainly the case that the assassin, Charles Guiteau, was mentally ill. His siblings reported later after the shooting that they had been worried about him. There was one incident where I think at his sister's house he had taken her puppy and dropped it down off the stairs. He became increasingly religious, so, you know, had felt like he was destined for greatness. So these things, I mean, there's no doubt that he was not quite right. However, he had helped the Republicans during the campaign, and he felt like that as a reward for his service to the Republican Party, he deserved a job. And when he was rejected, he decided that what he needed to do was to remove Garfield from the equation. He knew that Arthur was part of the wing in the Republican Party that believed in the spoil system, and he felt like Arthur might be more sympathetic to him.
Okay, spoiler alert, the wounded President Garfield lingered through the summer of 1881 and died that fall, 6.5 months after he had taken office. We'll pick up the story with author Scott Greenberger after a quick break. Not just Chester Arthur becoming president, but the surprising voice that shaped how he did it. The book is The Unexpected President. I'm Sheila Cass. Stay with us.
This is the On the Record podcast, a service of Your Public Radio, member-supported 88.1 WYPR. You can support this podcast and everything you hear from WYPR. Become a member. Come to WYPR.org and click the donate link.
Welcome back to On the Record. I'm Sheila Cast. Scott Greenberger is with me. He's a journalist who has written The Unexpected President, The Life and Times of Chester A. Arthur. Arthur was a Republican machine, Paul, from New York, who had been added to the 1880 Republican ticket to get the machine support. No one, including him, expected he would rise any higher in politics. Now, in the late summer of 1881, he is as horrified as other Americans that President Garfield is on the verge of death. And Chester, Arthur, gets a letter. Scott Greenberger, tell us who wrote him.
He got a letter shortly before Garfield died that August from a young woman from New York, as he was, named Julia Sand. She was 31 years old. She was bedridden or at least housebound. It's not clear exactly what sort of illnesses she suffered from, but she mentioned in her letters that she had some spinal pain and other things that very often kept her inside the house. This is a time, of course, when women did not have the ability to be involved in politics, and she was a politico, was very interested in politics, and she had never met Arthur. Arthur had never met her, but she sent him a letter as Garfield was on the verge of death, urging him to find his better self, to rise to the occasion. She acknowledged that much of the country was horrified at the prospect of Arthur becoming president.
Horrified because they thought this was going to be machine politics in the White House.
Yes, and beyond that, they felt that that Arthur and Conkling might have even had something to do with the Garfield assassination, because Garfield was, as his predecessor Hayes, trying to push reforms. They thought that perhaps Arthur and Conkling had something to do with the crime. And when Charles Guiteau was arrested right after he shot Garfield, he said, "I am a stalwart," which was that wing of the Republican Party, "and Arthur will be president." So there was a lot of suspicion. The press coverage was vicious, and Arthur was reeling.
How did Chester Arthur react to Julia Sand's letter?
One of the challenges in writing about Chester Arthur is that he didn't leave a lot behind. There's some letters that he wrote as a young man, but we don't know how he reacted in terms of him recording his thoughts in a diary or a letter. However, there are a few things that make us believe that that these letters had a great impact on him. For one thing, he heeded a lot of the advice that Julia Sand gave him, very specific political advice.
She wrote him altogether several dozen letters.
Almost two dozen letters over the next couple of years. The other thing is that once she had written him for about a year or so, Arthur came and paid her a surprise visit at her home in New York. And unannounced, he showed up to thank her for the letters and for her faith in him. And then also at the end of his life, Arthur ordered almost all of his papers to be burned. He was ashamed of the person and the politician he had been before he was president, but he ordered that Julia Sand's letters be kept.
And I guess the first public sign that he was listening to some new advisors was in December of 81, a couple months after he was inaugurated. He laid out his priorities in a public statement, and it included civil service reform.
People were shocked. This was in his annual message. It was then called the annual message. Now it's the State of the Union. It was a written message delivered to the president, delivered to Congress, and he called for civil service reform. There was civil service reform legislation languishing on Capitol Hill, but people were amazed that this guy, who was a creature of machine politics, who was a product of this system that civil service reform was supposed to eradicate, was now endorsing it.
This is On the Record on WYPR. I'm Sheila Cass speaking with journalist Scott Greenberger about his new book, The Unexpected President, The Life and Times of Chester A. Arthur. Civil service reform didn't pass right away. What put it over the top eventually?
What put it over the top was in 1882, the Republicans suffered pretty serious losses in the elections of 1882. And people interpreted that, especially because Arthur was perceived to have been involved in the election in New York. He went to New York, and people criticized him for sort of meddling in state politics again, just like he used to. In any case, when the Republicans did poorly in those elections, people interpreted that as a rebuke to machine politicians and machine politics. And finally, it seemed that the American people had had enough of this system. First, there had been the Garfield assassination, which, as you know, had at least a hint of the office-seeking motivation to it. Now these elections, so people in Congress finally decided, you know what, I think we have to do something about this issue.
And so they passed a bill that banned these so-called voluntary assessments, these kickbacks,
right,
and set up a testing system, a way of determining the qualifications of job applicants.
That's right.
Arthur signed it. Did he enforce it?
He did. He signed it, but even signing it wasn't really enough to convince people that he had changed because, as they noted at the time, as president, it would have been very easy for him to stall the regulations, to drag his feet on appointing members of a civil service commission. But he didn't do that. He was very vigorous in enforcing these laws. He really had had a change of heart. And I think another thing that's worth mentioning besides the Julius Sand letters is that long summer of when Garfield lingered on his deathbed really had an effect on Arthur, I think. There's a story told in the newspapers when a reporter came to his house to ask him what his reaction was to Garfield's death, and Arthur hadn't heard about it yet. The reporter is talking to Arthur's doorkeeper and wants a comment, and the doorkeeper says, well, I can't really get him now. He's in his office sobbing on his desk. I mean, he really was affected by the agony that Garfield went through, the treatment, the terrible treatment and the allegations in the press, and then the Julius Sand letters, the first of those letters that summer.
Early in his presidency, Arthur was diagnosed with Bright's disease and inflammation of the kidneys that at the time was almost always fatal. How did that affect his performance?
Well, I think it affected him very profoundly. It was difficult for him. Some of the symptoms of this disease were that he got tired very easily. He was very often nauseous. And there was some criticism when he was in the White House that he wasn't working hard enough, that he was keeping short hours. It wasn't real; those criticisms weren't really fair. But at the same time, there's no doubt that he was suffering from this disease. And in fact, a little later in his presidency, when he went down to Florida on vacation on his way back, he had a very serious attack while on board a ship outside Savannah, and the doctor who was on board really thought he might die. And when the news got out, people initially were shocked by this, of course. I mean, the president of the United States potentially dying, another president.
There was no vice president.
That's
that
right,
point,
and there was no vice president. But the White House, as it might do today, tried to combat the news reports and eventually sort of buried it, and people forgot about it.
Did he seek re-election?
He certainly, it seems like he would have welcomed renomination, but he knew that he had this disease, he knew that it was fatal, and he wasn't willing to do everything he could to get the nomination. Some of his closest aides had expected, heading into the convention in 1884, that he would use the power of the presidency, as previous presidents had, to build support. In other words, to use patronage to his advantage. But he didn't want to do that. He considered that to be inappropriate. And he knew he was ill. And then also, he was in a difficult place politically because the reformers still didn't completely trust him. And his old cronies in the machine despised him as a traitor. So he was sort of a man without a country in a way. And he was not renominated.
And he died just a few years later. He was 57.
Yes, he died in 1886 from Bright's disease. I think it's interesting to note when he died, uniformly, the newspapers praised him as a very successful president. They mentioned that he had exceeded everyone's expectations, that he had disappointed everyone's worst fears about what he might be as president. And some people went so far as to talk about him as one of the best presidents the country had ever had. And so I think it's fascinating that he's been almost completely forgotten. And I think part of that is that he burned his papers, as I mentioned, so there wasn't a lot left for historians. Part of it was that he was very shy in his dealings with the press because he felt like he'd been treated so harshly and unfairly during Garfield's illness. And also, I think part of it is what you alluded to early on, which is that this is a period of American history that's it's sort of foggy. I think most of us in school, we learn about the Civil War. maybe a little on Reconstruction. Then it's a quick fast forward to Teddy Roosevelt and the progressives and World War One. But I think Chester Arthur is worth remembering. I mean, he's a guy, the civil service reform really set the stage for the more activist federal government of Teddy Roosevelt and his successors. He, besides his legacy as president, I think it's a fascinating personal story of redemption that people can relate to. And I love the Julia Sand aspect of the story.
Thanks for telling us the story.
Thank you so much for having me.
Scott Greenberger's new book to be published tomorrow is The Unexpected President, The Life and Times of Chester A. Arthur. We have links to information about it at the On the Record page at WYPR.org. Greenberger, who lives in Tacoma Park, is executive editor of Stateline, a news website funded by the Pew Charitable Trust that covers state politics and policy for dozens of U.S. newspapers. This is On the Record. I'm Sheila Cast. Thanks for listening. Join us again tomorrow.
Thanks for listening to this segment of On the Record with Sheila Cast. You can catch the show on the radio Monday through Friday, 9:30 to 10 a.m. on 88.1 WYPR, your NPR news station. And you can support On the Record and all the other public radio programs that WYPR brings to you. Just click the donate link at the top of WYPR.org. And thanks.